Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu in the landmark year of 2014, our 10th year of operation. Or have we already completed?
We've completed 10. We're moving on to 11.
11, wow.
Unbelievable. And we hope, of course, that you had a wonderful holiday and a wonderful New Year celebration as well. We ourselves had a wonderful time. We were in the land of wind and wet. Strong gale force winds and driving rain in Cornwall, visiting with Peter's brother and family, but we didn't care.
We had
a wonderful time. So.
And we also had two dogs we could cuddle with.
Yeah, there you go.
a two-dog night. What is that?
Two cats. That's a three-dog night.
A three-dog night.
James Thurber, I think, coined it a two-dog night, and then somebody thought it was even more important to get an additional dog, and that was a rock group of some kind.
Not to mention two enormous cats.
Anyway, what are we going to do here today?
We have lots to do today. First of all, we're going to be talking to one of the most talented duos that I know. They seem to have a magic touch, individually and with the two of them working together. We'll be talking to Chef Rick Deschamps and his partner Tolga Sevdik about their newest venture, which has this intriguing name of Butcher and the Rock. Well, this dynamic duo has done it again. Rick Deschamps, chef, and Tolga Sevdik. You've started out as partners with a previous restaurant called Meat and Potatoes, which is a big hit in Pittsburgh. And now you have Butcher and the Rye, a gorgeous name, I might say. And it showcases great abilities. Richard, chef, you've been doing this for how long, the chefing business?
Too long. I started as a child. I started in the kitchen at 17. Uh-huh. And I went to culinary school at 9. I just turned 42. So, over 20-some years.
Right. And you've, in addition to formal training, you've had a lot of restaurant experience. Restaurants that you started on your own. And also, you spent a year sort of camping out, trying out different restaurants as a stage, right?
I staged around a lot, yeah, my early years. I lived in Colorado for a long time. I staged through Chicago, Puerto Rico. So I did kind of wanted to see the world and see different food and try different things and just kind of open my eyes up a little bit.
Well, I certainly have, and you have this ability to come out with these incredible concepts. At some point, I've said this to you before, I could just see you becoming a freewheeling restaurateur along the lines of Stephen Starr, because you have such great concepts and you set these places up with every single detail covered. But let's talk about your new restaurant, because we just experienced that, and I had so much fun there. It is a wonderful place. It's called Butcher and the Rye, and tell us the concept.
Well, it's kind of exactly what you said when you said you had fun there. That was kind of what we were going for. We wanted some fun, drink-driven, unpretentious, kind of unique little watering hole with great food. Coming off of Meat and Potatoes, which is kind of like on the same format, it just tweaked in a little different way. We wanted it to, tablecloth, heavy drink driven, but I'm so very heavy food driven as well.
Yeah, you're still cooking.
No, yeah, we're still cooking extremely a lot, to the point where it's a little more refined than Meat and Potatoes, a little more attention to detail, a little smaller plates, a little more farm to table. We have only two dining rooms, both hold 20. So we're only doing reservations for about 30 or 40 seats, and then we have communal tables in the front, and then we have the private cocktail bar upstairs for reservations as well.
Yeah, how do we give listeners an understanding of how detail-driven you are, the decor?
My mind don't stop, and I kind of like saying I don't really think I sleep at night. So if I'm not actually designing something or I'm not building something at the restaurant, I'm online trying to search chairs or tables. And it's for me, everything has to kind of make sense. Like, the food has to match the decor. The service has to match the type of food we're doing. The alcohol has to have, big influence as well. And so we try not to have no stones unturned. We actually really try to focus on every aspect from the purse hooks on the bar to...
Those little rabbits.
Yeah, the rabbits upstairs and downstairs are actually anti-door handles.
Are they really?
Yeah, and there's a lot of green going on. I mean, we actually all recyclable wood, the bar upstairs made out of old doors, all the lighting upstairs are actually all antique. 50% of the plates that we actually serve all our food on are all actually antique. I mean, as you go through this place, there's a lot of recycled, a lot of green, and even things when I actually built, like, ceilings out of reclaimed wood, then I turned around and took all the scraps, and I made little planks, and I used them into another area. So it's interesting to see how things overlap and how, like you said, attention to detail things are.
You do a lot of this work yourself. I mean, hands-on work. And you also employ a lot of local art talent.
Yeah, that's what we wanted to do. This space has a lot of different, we want, not your normal cookie-cutter style. We wanted to kind of break the mold a little bit with this space. We want to do something kind of unique and interesting, and being actually in the culture district and having gallery crawls and all the artists down here, I thought this place should show a lot of different artwork and things like that. So we have a lot of different pieces done by different artists, and like in the one upstairs room, the library room, there's actually all the tables are hand-painted from different artists. And I kind of wanted them to do their own thing. I wanted their own interpretation. So I actually took them through the space and showed them that what I was doing, and just kind of gave them a little free rein, say, what do you think of the space? And if you had to paint something, what would it be? And they all came up with different unique tables, which was kind of cool because they're all separate from each other. And you can tell different styles and different artworks.
Now, your partner, Tolga, has a special role in Meat and Potatoes and also at Butcher and the Rye, because when you opened Meat and Potatoes for the first time, we had the opportunity to sample the wonderful barrel cocktails that Tolga was brewing up. I think they were Manhattans and Negronis, unless my brain got fried. But then Butcher and the Rye
and the Rye
went to a new level. So who's going to own up to the fact that they wanted to have more than 400 bourbons behind the bar? Whose idea was that?
I think it's Tolga's insanity right there.
Tolga, you were fixated, and you're new to the industry. You are not a lifelong restaurateur, but you really got hooked, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, I am. Now, I actually went to Duquesne University for marketing. After I graduated, I just did some marketing for a steel company, and I hated it. I was working as a door guy at a restaurant club, and I loved the business, became the manager, GM. That's how I actually met Rick and worked for Rick at 909. And he just basically told me, my next restaurant, I want to make you a partner, and which he did. We opened Meat and Potatoes, now Butcher and the Rye, and we're working on different concepts. But the bourbon, I did work on the bourbon list, but it was just basically, me and Rick, like he explained, when we walk into space, what can we do with the space? Everything has to kind of match each other. And then we say, let's do that crazy, amazing bourbon list, something like one of the best lists in the country.
I mean, you said it was more bourbons than anybody in the country. Is that true?
What we did was GQ magazine come out with this best whiskey bars in the country. And we opened the magazine and we hit some of these places that they were showing the best whiskey bars. And they're not even close to what we have in-house. Some of the stuff we display, actually we have more stuff than we display because we just think there's not much space to display. But we worked hard on it. I did work almost like 6-7 months just to create that list and put it together.
And you have a whole cocktail program going as well, right?
Yes, we do. We hire some of the best bartenders in the city. Mike Mills is running our bar program. He was actually our bar manager at Meat and Potatoes. Now he oversees the build places. The new talent that we hired, we have one of the best bar program in the city, maybe the best.
Now, you do offer wine, but one of the things you seem to favor is cocktails or liquor throughout the meal, which is an interesting and different idea. I mean, we've had whiskey-tasting menus. We haven't had cocktails for dinner every night together with our food. Now, what was behind that idea?
Cocktails, everybody can do a wine pairing, but there's more things that you can do with the cocktail. Do like Chef Rick's food, there's so many ingredients. And we can come up with, there's so many liquors, there's so many aperitifs out there, we can come up with some kind of different cocktails that we can match better than any wine with the food that we're serving. That was our idea. You know, if we're serving a certain kind of thing, we can match it with this type of cocktail, with this type of liquor, and just come up with some kind of perfect pairing.
Rick, I love your names.
Yeah, Rick, you want to give us...
My take on it is, well, first off, I believe strongly in picking your animal and picking and doing amazing. And for us, picking bourbon was what we're going to go after. I would rather do one concept and blow it out of the water and be the best ever and go 100% for like just bourbon, opposed to trying to do bourbon, trying to do gigantic wine lists, trying to do just gigantic beer list. So for us, it was figured we wanted to focus on bourbon, and that was what we're going to be. And for drinks are, especially with the mixologists and the bartenders, the way they're going this, you know, right now, I mean, it's changing, and it's a different scene. And with Maggie and Mike and Erica, and it's kind of like cooking. I mean, they're there as long as I am. They get there. Their bartenders get there at like times 11 o'clock in the morning. They're there on their days off. They're making all their own syrups, they're making different bitters, and they're really, it's an interesting craft, and it's the same thing as like food. It's just a layer of flavors. Picking your ingredients, picking the season, picking what you want to do, and then just layering these different ingredients together and coming up with something special is the kind of the same way we do food. So I just thought it would just be such a unique thing to have these great bartenders / chef bartenders and then us really come together and create a unique experience. So that's kind of what our folks behind that.
Now, give us an idea of what a typical meal might consist of, like this cocktail and this dish, this cocktail and this dish, this cocktail and this dish, through an evening at Butcher and Rye.
Well, we change our menu frequently, and we work, you know, like I have actually a special board, which my waiters be telling me, whoa, slow down, because I do keep pulling things and doing creative. And the way the food is, it's super refined, but it's also super simple and straightforward. Like I do a lamb sauce, lamb neck gravy, which we actually do. We braise lamb neck in like a tomato sauce, and we serve it with whipped ricotta and grilled bread. So it's kind of like the plate. When you look at the plate, it looks real elegant and something, and then it's actually rustic at the same time. You have this reclaimed wood and these animal heads, but then you have this beautiful velvet wallpaper and these marble tables. The food, I think, kind of almost resembles the same thing. It actually, we're using like great ingredients, Elysian Field lamb, but we're presenting it in more of a rustic format. So, and then as far as the bartenders go, I mean, it just depends on what I'm doing for the day. I'll talk to them and say, hey, I have this squab dish I did last week. And so once again, you know, we're doing squab and, I added some foie gras in there, and we did kabocha squash. And then I talked to them, and so I put cherries in the squab dish, and they started working on like an old fashioned and doing something like that, like a heavy game type of dish with an old fashioned. So it's like I said, it just depends on the day and what we're into. And as far as, you know, we're still new. We've only been open 4 weeks, so.
Well, how did word get out so fast? I mean, we were there early, and by the time we left, the place was jammed. I mean, you said that you sometimes need crowd control on weekends.
We do. We have actually, we have 2 to 3, which is insane for Pittsburgh, but we do have 2 to 3, like, we have, like, doormen at will, just to kind of monitor it. It's somebody upstairs, and then we have 1 or 2 people outside. And it's, you know, some people don't react well to this. I don't think they understand that we're trying to, it's not like we're singling out people like, oh, you're not good enough to come in here. But we want the people that are actually in here to have a good time. And it's a fine line between, like, it's busy and packed and you're having a good time, and it's busy and it's crowded and you're having a bad time. You can't get a drink. The service is hard. So it's not about, because if it was about money, pack it up and say yippee and just, you know, go into it. But for us, it's about our customers and the people that are actually inside to really enjoy the experience they're having. So we try to monitor it. And it's, like I said, it don't come off always great because they think it's like singling out or it's new to Pittsburgh. Like, well, we're just going to the bar. Well, we're actually all booked at the bar right now. And they just, they're having a bad, hard time reacting with it. But the main thing is the people that are actually inside are having a great time. And that's kind of our focus.
Now, you do some interesting things. What you think might be traditional turns out it really isn't. Your shepherd's pie is a good example. mean, I know what shepherd's pie is supposed to look like because my mother used to fix it. But yours is just a little, the concept just a little bit different.
Well, yeah, like I said, we like to have fun here. We like to, it's a balance of the ingredients, but I like to use things that people can relate with a little bit, like say shepherd pie, or we do play on dumplings, instead of chicken and dumplings, we do rabbit and dumplings, and then we just, you know, we do a lot of bone marrow, but the shepherd pie is, we actually do cheeks, and we braise them off. We marinate them overnight, then we braise them for like 6 hours, then we pull them, then we clean them, and then we make a sauce out of them. And then it's almost like an elegant dish where we do the cheeks, and then we do cream peas with bacon and mint, and then we do like a roasted carrots that we actually sous vide, and a little butter, honey, and then we actually roast them off. And then we do a potato foam on top of that, which is Yukon Golds, and then we actually add a lot of olive oil. We cook them off traditionally, and then we puree them up, and we put them in an ISI container, kind of like a whipped cream, and then we actually put this really rich, you know, Yukon Gold and olive oil, and it's kind of like a topping on top of these cheeks, just to kind of make this velvety, rich, intense flavor. So
now you're big on pig, so you have two pigs. You have pigs with wings,
yeah,
and pig candy. Tell us about those, and then we'll ask Tolga to tell us what he would recommend as a drink to go with them.
Okay. Well, right now, I guess that's the only two. We do change, like I said, we change a lot, but we have the pig candy is just the pork belly, and like I said, we kind of have a fun thing with things. So what we did is we actually put a dry rub on it, and we cure it overnight, and then we slow roast it in the oven for about 3.5 hours, and then we pull it out, and then we chill it. And then we cut it, and then we actually roast it off to it's like really golden brown. And some of the cure that we put on it has a little bit of sugar on it, so it starts getting this beautiful crusty, like caramelized on the outside. And then we do a miso, like butterscotch with it, a miso caramel at will. And then we just take miso, we make a caramel sauce, we actually add miso to it, a little bit of butter. So it's like this butterscotch caramel sauce on top of it, and then we pair it with kimchi apples, which we use apples, daikon, celery. We make a kimchi porridge. So you kind of get this spicy, you know, and then you get the sweet, and then you get the richness of the fat. And we just top it with a little bit of cilantro and fresh radish, just for a little peppery, for the bite, for the radish.
Now, what would we drink with that, Tolga?
Which is sour. It'd be a great perfect answer, which is a cocktail we have. And our bar, which ingredients are, we got rye whiskey in there, and a fresh made sour, and the whiskey bitters.
Okay, how about one more dish, and let's start off with Tolga. Tolga, one of your favorite cocktails, and then we'll ask Rick to pair a dish with it.
I'm just gonna go with our bourbons.
Okay.
Definitely, yeah. Pick one of the bourbons. My favorite right now, what I'm drinking after a long day, is Black Maple Hill. 12 years old.
Okay.
It's one of my favorites. That's one of my biggest suggestions to any customer that who wants first time want to try a bourbon, and I just go with the Black Maple Hill.
And what would we eat along with that, Rick?
Which year did you pick, Tolga?
Black Maple Hill.
12 year. I would pick something that's going to stand out. It's a little bitey, heavy game.
I liked your dirty pasta, actually.
Yeah, the dirty pasta. I love that pasta, too. That actually would go well with that, just because, you know, you've got the livers, the richness of the duck. We actually grind all our duck in-house, and then we deglaze it with a little bit of brandy. So it's kind of like a play on when you think of if you're going to make a pate or dirty rice. We actually take the whole ducks, we break them, I grind all the breasts and the legs, and then I take all the livers, then I actually confit all the hearts and gizzards, and so we kind of deconstruct it all, and then I make a stock out of the bones. So when we make the pasta itself, we actually start with the ground duck, the livers, and then we add a little shallot, a little garlic, and then we deglaze with a little brandy, and then I add the duck stock into that, and then we actually add the gizzards and the hearts back into it. So, I mean, something like that would actually go amazing.
Okay, so there we are with our with our Maple Hill 12-year-old.
Yeah, let's do a website.
Yes,
and
yes.
I think reservations are absolutely recommended. Although you do have some space set aside for walk-ins, right?
We do in the front area. We have two large communal tables. Plus, everyone's welcome at the bar to drink or to eat. Excuse me. So it does get a little busy.
Busy. So what about the website?
The website basically just directs you to make reservation by on the phone.
The website is?
Our website is butcherandtherye.com.
Butcherandtherye.com. That's correct. Great. Well, you two are amazing. And, I can't wait to get back and find out what else you're up to. And you're still already thinking about your next concept. I can't believe it.
Well, we have a space next door that's kind of connected to Butcher.
Oh, I wanted to mention that. Yes, I forgot about that because that's in the works now.
Yeah, that is actually, we're in construction right now. It's a little taqueria. It's 2,000 square feet. It's actually going to be connected to Butcher. So it just made sense for us. It was an empty building. It, was an eyesore. It just was a smart play. And we thought kind of pick one thing and kind of go at it and try to make it amazing. I thought, why don't we kind of do the same reproduction of like tequila and mezcal and kind of street food. And so it's going to kind of fit in the same format, but it'll be a little more tequila driven.
Well, as I said, you two are both amazing and keep up.
Thank you.
Bringing up all these wonderful concepts. You certainly elevated the dining options in this city quite a lot. All right. Until the next time I see you both. Ciao, huh?
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more meat and potatoes in a way right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net. Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And I know a lot of people find lamb exotic. I don't. I adore lamb. In fact, it's my very most favorite meat. And a top producer is just around the corner. Well, not literally around the corner, but pretty close by. Suki and John Jamison. And they're going to bring us up to date on the state of lamb.
And that's the meat part of the... So hold on after John and Suki to find out what the potatoes part is.
I'm not quite sure how to introduce our next guests, Suki and John Jamison of Jamison Farm. You fill so many different niches in my life, John and Suki. I mean, you're my go-to information about anything having to do with lamb, and actually probably farming in general. You also are a good source for a social calendar. You have good friends, and you've got good recipes. So you are in southwestern Pennsylvania, and I think we're blessed to have you here. But your market is all across the United States. How did you? When did you? Can you condense that? Get involved with purchase of this farm and starting your lamb production.
Well, goodness gracious. We bought a farm in La Trobe in 1976 without meaning to buy a farm. We bought an old stone house that was built in 1798, and the purpose was to restore the farm. The guy wouldn't sell restore the house, and the seller would not sell me the house unless I bought 65 acres that went with it. So we had to figure out what to do with the 65 acres. So after a certain period, Suki decided that sheep wouldn't break things down and cows would, so we started raising sheep. And that's really kind of where it all started. And she started with a flock for a 4-H project, which was 14 ewes. that's females, mommies, and one ram who was 14 years old, but he still was able to produce lambs the following spring. So that's how it started.
Now, fast forward, John, to today. How many animals do you have now?
Well, we have, at any one time on the farm, we have about 500, and that's a mixture of ewes, mothers who may or may not have lambs at the time, and lambs that we are finishing on the grass that we buy from local farmers at weaning, and then we finish them on our grass, because the grass in this part of Pennsylvania is probably, if not the best, one of the best areas in the country in which to raise lamb.
Now, we just got back from the green and pleasant land of Ireland, though, which claims to have better grass than anywhere else in the whole world, and it sure looks like it. It's the greenest,
sure.
The greenest grass
beautiful.
You've ever seen in your whole life. Now, they are in a position, I understand, where their grass grows 12 months out of the year. Now, that's not true in Western Pennsylvania. You have some cold stuff and some white stuff that sort of gets in the way, so you have to do
yes.
something different then.
Yes, it does. It makes a difference, although what we do, the lambs and the ewes are outside all year round, and the last couple winters have been rather mild. And even though we have round bales of hay, which is grass, of course, cured into hay, the animals have access to that at all time. But they, even if there's some snow on the ground, they will dig through the snow to get the grass. And it's there. It's just not in very much abundance. But certainly from mid-March until December, certainly of last year, they were eating grass the whole time. And our lambs and ewes are just outside. I mean, they're fences, but there's no shelter except for the trees, and they're sheltered out of the wind that way, and they're perfectly happy.
Yeah, I was surprised when you told me that you let the old lamb outside because there was less infection and
yes,
yeah, that's more natural and
yes,
more
it is.
Sterile.
What we do is we lamb in May where the grass has started growing and everything's fine, and it just seems that they're happier and everybody's healthy. Yes.
Now, you're well known in the industry, especially well known by all the famous chefs that seek out your lamb.
Yes.
And it goes back to Julia Child and Jean-Louis Paladin. And you said even Alice Waters, you keep in touch with her?
Yes, we do. Actually, we do an event with Joan Nathan.
Okay, yeah.
Who I think you know.
Yes.
And she has an event in January in Washington, D.C. to raise money for the D.C. Central Kitchen and for Martha's Table. And Alice cooks there every year, and she uses our lamb every year. And she was doing an interview with someone, and we were talking and kind of kibitzing back and forth. And she had reminded me that she bought lamb from us before she bought from some local farmers that she uses now in Berkeley, because it was before she could find it. So we've been selling to her, I guess, since the mid-80s. I can't even remember.
Now, Suki, you're the one responsible for deciding about the lambs. How did you learn to become a lamb farmer?
How did I learn? Well, trial and error. There was a lot of
that.
Okay. But I was doing cooking, and I had small catering way back then, and I liked the taste of our lamb when I would do my cooking versus what I would buy in the stores. And
oh,
so that's
yeah.
why we pursued the going after the lamb market, because we thought it was better ourselves.
So you could see the difference. Now, did the Penn State University Extension, did they help you? I mean, they're supposed to do that kind of thing, aren't they?
Well, they are supposed to, and in the beginning I did, because I knew nothing. I mean, I really knew nothing. We went through the 4-H project, and that's where you learn about animal husbandry for the 4-H extension agents help you with that. But as we got more adept at what we were doing, we decided that grass was much better suited for the animals than grain. And so we decided to try grass. We built fences and did rotational grazing. And rather than feeding our lambs all corn and a grain mix, we decided to try lamb because they're very suited to that.
Yeah, are they, I mean, like cows, they're just not even equipped biologically to process grain.
That's correct.
Not to that extent. The way that lamb is raised in this country is in feedlots in the West, and they have free access to grain all day, and all they do is stand around and eat. And they don't get the exercise, and they don't get the nutrition that you're going to get out of the grass pastures.
No. And the taste and the meat. That was when we first met Jean-Louis, the story I go on and tell about him when he was reduced to tears, not because Suki's so beautiful, but the lamb was so beautiful. But anyway, he was the first one that really told us that lamb tastes like what it eats, and I had never really thought about it much and certainly didn't have a sophisticated palate as he. But anyway, that was when we started really seeing grass is not only the proper way to do it, but it also enhanced the taste of the meat.
Now, you just slipped by this thing called rotational grazing, but this was, I think, I want to mention two things about it, and just then you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
I think you told us years ago that, in fact, the French grazed lamb in the way that you do it now. They moved them in groups from field to field to field.
Correct.
And how they did it without electric fences, I don't know, but you found it possible to do that because of the invention and your ability to be able to deploy electric fences.
Yes, that's right. And, yes, what happened was there was a guy named André Voisin, V-O-I-Z-I-N, who wrote a book called Grass Productivity in the 30s, and he researched this back a couple hundred years in France, in England, really everywhere, Europe and the Isles, and with stone fences and other things, and people were doing essentially the same sort of thing that is easier to do now with the technology of electric fencing.
So what's happened is it's much more convenient for you.
Yes, that's correct.
And
it's easier to control, and really we're able to put them on a smaller area for a shorter period of time where they just eat everything down and get really fresh feed almost every day.
So you essentially, you're also all natural.
Yes.
No hormones, no antibiotics.
No.
None of that stuff.
Right.
I mean, are you in the forefront of the gold standard of a lamb production in this country?
Oh, yeah, I would think so.
I would think so, too.
Yeah,
I always thought we should call our lamb something different than a lamb in America because it doesn't taste like any lamb in America because most lamb is from feedlots, and it's a total difference.
But there are a lot more.
It's totally different.
But there are a lot more lamb growers now than there used to be. I mean, individual lamb growers. I was curious. Why do you think, I am not typical, I was raised on lamb, why is it that lamb is still viewed as kind of an odd meat by a lot of Americans?
Well, if by odd you mean taste,
unusual. I mean that they don't think of it in the same terms they think of.
They weren't brought up with it. I think people in America today hardly, if you didn't grow up with it in your family, which is people have gotten away from so much that it's like an odd, you're right, it's an odd meat that people just don't even know about. And it's not carried in a lot of grocery stores.
No.
So they're not going to be exposed to it.
And restaurants, too. I mean, the same thing.
Restaurants, too. And so it's taken on a name or a view of being a high-end meat, which it is a high-end meat. But it's gourmet, it's natural, it's everything. But people just don't know about it.
Well, do you have a lamb marketing board, like the pork marketing board and the egg marketing board?
Yes, that's right. There's an American Lamb Board, which is really promoting it's a commodity production board. So in our situation, and this is true really all over the country and has been for the last 20 years or so, when you have small sustainable producers, really any commodity, they really aren't part of that. It's a separate situation, and the products are different. And so it's
it really doesn't benefit the small producer.
Yeah.
But we still have to be not a member, whatever they call you, because
yeah.
we raise sheep. We have to be part of that organization,
okay, so,
even though it doesn't apply to us.
So
wow.
it's like a mandatory trade association.
Now, that's
exactly,
correct. Yeah, we
exactly.
have to pay into it. It's under the USDA. It's mandatory.
Okay. Now your marketing goes mostly to restaurants, right? You go
We've
direct.
We've done all our own marketing over the years.
But you directed mostly at people who, shall we say, could appreciate the difference because they know the difference.
Yes, and what happened when we started, it was pretty much 50-50, I would say, restaurants and home chefs. When we really started in the mid-80s, I thought that people would be interested in it is having something like Omaha Steaks, but from a small farm and a specific type of meat or species. But then after we did that event, which I've told you about before, that people in Pittsburgh may remember, but there was a large event in 1988 at Lamont as a fundraiser for Children's Hospital.
Oh, right.
And there were seven of the best chefs in the country at that time there, and Wolfgang Puck was supposed to do our lamb, but his wife was having their first child, and so they brought a then-unknown 30-year-old chef from New York to cook the lamb, and that was Jean-Georges Vongerichten. And so he ended up cooking our lamb, and we became friends, and we met all the French chefs, and that's really how all that started. And Jean-Louis was at that dinner also, and Paul Prudhomme, and Ferdinand Metz, who was the president of the CIA. But, yes, that's when we started selling to restaurants, because we needed somebody to buy the lamb every week, where before we were selling at Easter and we were selling at gifts for the fall and winter holiday season.
I love your stories about these chefs and your different experiences. You are writing a book. You and Suki, are you writing the same book or two different books?
Oh, he writes and I edit.
Yes, which means she writes it.
So, but anyhow,
it's a collaboration.
Yeah.
All right. So, but you're telling anecdotes in that book, or it's not anecdotes, but your experiences, the
yes.
stories there, and then you also will have recipes, which is, of course, the other aspect of your business. I mean, Suki's such a great cook, but
right.
Just tell us some of the people you're talking about in this book, because I mean, I love your stories.
Well, the stories are about the first one that we talk about is Jean-Louis Paladin, because he for a few reasons. Number one, he was the first that really made us famous, and he was such a character and so much fun that he's great to write about. For the story I always tell is when he comes to the farm and sees the lambs and on the hill, and he says, how many sheep's on the hill? And I said, oh, about 600 or 700. And he says, how many mummies? And I said, 400. And he said, how many daddies? And I said, 5. And he went, ooh la la. And so it was, it's on and on with all these guys, because they're all characters. At least it seemed to be the ones that we met were characters, and some of the names would be Jean-Louis, Julia Child, Danielle Boulud, and Dan Barber, as far as today's chefs go, and Michael Simon before he was famous, and it just...
Melissa?
It was a lot of fun, and Alice. And all of this, and also Norman Van Aken, I thought about him because he's writing a book that's coming out in a month or two, or wrote a book that's coming out in a month or two, and it's kind of this, it's the chef's perspective of of how all of this has changed in the last 20 or 30 years. So it's kind of similar in thought as where we are, I think.
Well, you know, there's something important that we have to say here before we wrap this is people are going to be wanting this lamb. How does somebody go about getting it?
Suki?
We have a website. Of course we do. JamisonFarm.com.
JamisonFarm singular.com. And then we also have an 800 number, which is 800-237-LAMB, which is 5262.
And sometimes you show up in supermarkets even.
Yes, we've been known to do that.
I was so disappointed when that we won't use their name on the air, but we all know who it is.
Yes.
And I guess they ran a sort of a bake-off, I think, and I suspect in their case it was a price bake-off.
Yes.
And I think you also did some work with Whole Foods here, right in my near neighbors, just down the street.
Yeah, we have in the past. Yes.
Yeah. Well, listeners, it's great lamb, and they're great stories, and thank you, dear friends, Suki and John. When you have another party,
thank you.
I love your farm.
Us.
We love your parties at your farm.
Oh,
we've been having
fun.
Lots of fun, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Well, continued good luck to you, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll see you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a quick break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We've been promising you vegetables, or rather potatoes, for the final segment. In fact, it's vegetables in general. And our old friend Joe Yonan, who is the food editor for the Washington Post, I think, sweetheart. And he's on a new kick called All About Getting Healthy by Eating More Vegetables, a message that we brought to you with several different guests. But Joe makes it so easy because his
recipes are
so absolutely delicious.
But it's a whole new world, a new way of looking at vegetables today, I think.
Good,
more and more people are looking at vegetables as prized,
right.
Delicious.
Okay,
eats.
So the book is called Eat Your Veg.
Vegetables.
Do that more successfully after you've listened to this next segment of the program.
You know, I think that I'm going to be talking to a totally different person from the last Joe Yonan that I interviewed. He seemed to have had a major transformation in the year since we talked.
Well, it may seem more major than it actually was. It's sort of like a kid who hasn't seen a relative in many years during a period of growth, seeming as if they shot up overnight. But really, there's been incremental changes happening all along.
I see. Well, just to be formal about this, Joe Yonan is the food editor for the Washington Post, which is another whole story. But you're also the author of a new book called Eat Your Vegetables, subtitled Bold Recipes for the Single Cook, which is a niche that you've kind of developed for yourself, cooking for one.
That's right.
Right. You indicate in the introduction to this, I might say, by the way, off the record, after we interviewed you, you sort of disappeared into the wilds of New England, and I was I couldn't figure out what you were doing. You mentioned something about a farm experiment. Tell us what you were doing.
Last year, I decided to, well, I should say toward the end of 2011, I decided to go live with my sister and brother-in-law in southern Maine for all of 2012. They own and operate what they call a homestead, which is sort of like a selfish farm, and they're not selling anything. They're trying to grow as much of their own food as they can and working toward some level of self-sufficiency all the time, getting closer and closer. And I wanted to see what it took to do that. I wanted to learn more about growing food, certainly, and I wanted to see what it really entails in Maine to grow so much of your own food.
Yeah, well, that was a good challenge because it's very cold in Maine.
Yeah, more and more farms and homeowners and homesteaders, as they refer to it, have been pushing the boundaries of the seasons in New England for many years, thanks to really the inspiration of people like Elliot Coleman, who's a gardening writer guru who has taught people how to extend the seasons with hoop houses and greenhouses and
right.
and row covers and things like that. But it's still a challenge, and it involves a lot of not just growing but preservation, putting up and canning and jarring and drying and freezing.
Yeah, it's, it's funny. We just got back from Ireland, and we made up. It was almost a pilgrimage, a 250-mile pilgrimage, to the very northern part of the Republic of Ireland, to meet a man who took over his father's restaurant called Harry's, and there's an adjunct location called Harry's Bar, not the one in Venice or the one in London.
Yeah.
And what he's doing is he's growing all the vegetable products. That he uses in his restaurant, 100%.
Right.
And he's doing it with tunnels. He has four or five different locations.
I mean, I never knew there's not any place where you can get a tomato ripening in that area.
Except they use tunnels. They use these wonderful tunnels.
Yeah.
And I guess the same, you experience the same thing.
Right. And you work with the season. You put up hundreds of jars of tomato sauce. You don't expect to have ripe tomato in the middle of February, of course. You want tomatoes, you wait until they're ripe and in season, and you adjust your cooking to suit that. And if you want tomato sauce February, you pull out tomato sauce that you jarred when your tomatoes were coming in.
Or you do like we did at the end of the season, which is Anne's ingenious. He puts the last of the tomatoes in plastic bags and sticks them in the freezer.
Sure.
And untreated, and we take them out and take the skins off. This wasn't the only thing that was hatching in your fertile imagination either, because it's a certain length of time to produce a book, and here's a beautiful one we have in front of us right now. When did you start on that?
Yes, you're totally right. I also worked on Eat Your Vegetables the whole year that I was there. So every morning, my agreement with my brother-in-law and sister was every morning I gave them 4 or 5 hours of my time out on the homestead, and that entailed shoveling manure, picking bugs, weeding, of course, planting and harvesting. And then the rest of the day I worked on Eat Your Vegetables, testing recipes, writing, interviewing people for the essays that I wrote, and trying to conceive of interesting new way to talk to people about vegetables and how kind of creative you can be about them if you allow yourself to be.
Now, when you were doing all this testing, did your adopted family like it or did they not like it?
Yeah, no, they loved it.
Okay.
It was interesting that I was working on another book that was aimed at single cooks while I was living with my sister and brother-in-law. So I was also certainly cooking a lot with them and for them, things that didn't necessarily end up in the book that may show up in other projects down the road. But no, they had a great time. We all had a really fun time. My sister is my favorite person in the world to cook with, and she has a very natural ability in the kitchen. And she had been vegetarian for many, many, many years and had recently, only in the last, I think, really 10 years, started eating meat again, really when she met her husband. And it was probably because they were raising meat, raising chickens for meat, and certainly working with a lot of other homesteaders and farmers around trading products and getting locally raised meat. But they recently decided to become vegan, and that actually happened coincidentally when I was there. My brother-in-law read the China Study and decided to stop eating any animal products. And I was, meanwhile, already wondering how I was going to coordinate the writing of a vegetable cookbook, a vegetarian cookbook, with the fact that we were thinking about ordering pigs on the homestead.
Yeah,
and so I was kind of relieved when they went vegan, because I felt myself confirming my vegetarianism kind of simultaneously, and so I was relieved when they decided to turn vegan. And then I sort of was able to then feel a little more confident focusing on vegetables and vegetarianism. And so it was a learning process for all of us. We kind of were discovering a lot of this together. They've since loosened up a little bit on the veganism. I had originally come up with a term for them. I called it vegan, V-A-G-U-E hyphen A-N, and then a vegan who was kind of vague on the details. But we had a lot of fun cooking together.
Yeah, you say that. I like your approach to, you want to call this a vegetable cookbook, not a vegetarian cookbook.
That's
and
right.
That was the point of view of, we interviewed, what's her name, from Dirt Candy?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and of course that's what how they label their restaurant, too.
Amanda Cohen, yes.
Amanda Cohen, yeah. And you know, she said it's about vegetables, not about vegetarianism.
And I think the difference is important because too much focus on vegetarianism, I feel like, emphasizes the lack of meat rather than the presence of vegetables. So it's about what's not on the plate rather than what is on the plate. And I, like Amanda and like some other restaurateurs, I'm thinking of the people at Veg in Philadelphia, Rich Landau and Kate Jacoby. They, too, have this philosophy that be writing about vegetables and telling people about vegetable dishes because the vegetables are delicious and versatile, not just because the dish doesn't happen to have bacon in it.
In our recent restaurant adventure, I said in the interview, and I said it before that to Anne, I said, the problem with this, these vegetables are so good.
Yeah, right.
That I'm never going to want to eat another turnip because the turnip I just had was so absolutely insanely delicious.
Right.
Yeah, see, that's it. The availability, I mean, access is part of the issue here, I think.
And this is a big part of the challenge that you had in putting together this book and the challenge you decided to take up, right? It's not easy buying a head of cabbage for one.
That's right, but it's pretty easy buying Brussels sprouts for one. I call them my single person's cabbage, little itsy-bitsy cabbages. And cabbage is probably not even the best example because cabbage, unlike so many other things, stores really well.
Oh, forever, yeah.
So you don't have to worry about it quite as much. You know, the one that always gets me, and I think we might have even talked about this the last time, is celery. Celery is...
Oh, yeah, right.
There's no recipe that calls for the minimum amount of celery that you have to buy in the supermarket. No, you're right, though, about a couple of things. Quality is very important. I tell people when they ask me what my tips are in making satisfying vegetable dishes or in converting people who may not like vegetables into vegetable eaters, if not lovers, the first thing is about quality. And quality is related to freshness with vegetables, possibly even more than meat.
Oh, yeah.
And seasonality. Try to still have this mentality that you should be able to walk into a supermarket any day of the year and get any vegetable that's on the ingredient list of whatever recipe you're working on. That's folly. The best way to make delicious vegetable-focused dishes is to pay attention to the quality and freshness and seasonality of the vegetables that you're working with, and then you'll just be a step ahead. Of course, then you need to know what to do with them
right
when you get them home and how to cook them in a way that makes them as satisfying and delicious as they possibly can be. But
there's a one-stop shop for that now. All you have to do is buy this book.
Well, there you said it.
Now, you've organized this book with, you do like a little essay on a subject, and then you do your recipes.
That's right.
And introduce each recipe, too. Tell us some of the subjects that you cover in your, I call them the yellow pages.
Yeah. These
no,
are different yellow
green.
Pages. You're
green.
Not. They're green. That's right. They're green. That's true. That's right. Well, I realized when I was working on the book that I really want to write, and sometimes writing actual recipes isn't all that satisfying. You can certainly tell fun stories in the headnotes, and I try to do that in the introductions to the recipes. But I did feel like I had things that I wanted to say in a little bit more depth. So I write about things such as the death of my community garden and in D.C. and the effect that had on me when the owners of the land decided after 20-plus years to pave paradise, as I call it, put up a parking lot, to quote Joni Mitchell. And
we have done that a number of times recently.
Yeah, you've quoted Joni Mitchell?
Oh, yeah.
It's always smart, I find.
the funny part about it is it was at least 15 years before I understood that that was actually the lyric.
Oh, yes. Yes. She wasn't in an interview when she said that. That's right.
She wasn't making it very clear at all.
That's right. I also write about my mixed feelings about imitation meat, mock meat.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that because, you know, I really hate that. My vegan cousin came for Thanksgiving dinner one year, and she wanted that stuff that looks like a slice of turkey.
Tofurkey?
Yes. I hated that.
Yeah.
It was the most disgusting object.
It was disgusting. It
didn't even look like a turkey.
Until you start thinking about it, it's a little mystifying as to why vegetarians wouldn't just eat vegetables. There's a lot of reasons for it. I am pretty skeptical of a lot of them, too, because I think that there are too many processed ingredients and preservatives and stabilizers and the like in them that I don't really want to be eating in my food. But I do think that there's a couple reasons why people are interested in them. One is, of course, protein and just trying to think of an easy way to get protein. And the other is this idea of familiarity, something that connects them to the meat that they used to eat. And I think it depends on where you're coming from. I did enjoy reading about and researching some of the cultural history to imitation meats and realizing that there are viable traditions to some of them, particularly seitan, the wheat.
Right.
But I do think that it can be difficult to justify depending too much on some of these products when, if you want a diet that's rich in natural foods and organic food and healthy food. So I have kind of mixed feelings about it. I know that some of the makers of these foods would say that anything that helps people eat less meat and more plants is a good thing.
But that's sort of like an alcoholic drinking fake beer out of the can. Where,
right.
Yeah.
Right. You're like, why don't you just have some tea?
It's that little bit of alcohol they leave behind. You just, so
right.
You just have to drink more. It's not zero alcohol. It's just less.
Right.
And,
right.
And it tastes horrible.
Right.
Do you ever notice that? I mean, it
I've never had it.
It doesn't. It really tastes terrible.
I think that any time you're comparing directly, you get into trouble too. I would rather eat something that tastes, that's a beautiful example of what it actually is, rather than something that is trying to remind you of something else.
That what are the two or three things that you think you solved in your research and that you then wrote down in this book? Because we aren't going to be able to go over it all on the air. All we can do is encourage people to say, this is obviously worth exploring, and not only do you have great recipes, but you also have a great philosophy of life that says it's possible
Thanks.
To eat vegetables for one. But what were a couple of the things that were really the hardest where you think you made a real discovery?
Well, I think one is this idea that people, this is truer for single people than it is for others, but it's true for all of us, really. It's a bad idea to be getting off work and to not have thought yet, really, about what you're going to have for dinner, and to pick some recipe at random, or seemingly at random, that's based on just what you feel like eating, but that's not related at all to what you actually already have in your house, and to start there and to think that you have to go to the supermarket on your way home after a long day at work and fill up that ingredient list and then cook it all once you get home and then think that you're going to do anything except eat dinner at around 10 o'clock at night and be angry and hungry by the time you do it. I really feel like it's a much better practice to make building blocks of dishes on the weekend when you have time, things that can then be integrated into quick weeknight meals, that can be the basis of quick weeknight meals. So a pot of beans, a pan of marinated and baked tofu, a pot of rice, that kind of thing. Caramelize some onion, make some condiments, make some kimchi.
Yeah, I do the kimchi you mentioned. I think the one thing interesting about this book is you did this in Maine, but this is not like American or just New England food. You have a lot of Asian food recipes in here, too.
Yeah, my palate tends to veer toward Asian, Southwestern, Mexican. I grew up in West Texas, but I have traveled a lot, and I've gotten inspired by food in many parts of the world. And Asia is certainly high up on that list. A lot of the recipes are things that I was inspired to make based on what I was harvesting at the time in Maine, but just an intuitive kind of sense of what I craved and what I wanted to eat, and I tend to gravitate toward those flavors a lot, it's true. But also Spanish and Italian certainly show up a lot in my dishes. But yes, it's not a New England book by any stretch of the imagination. But so the building block idea is one thing that I feel really strongly about, that you then, if you've got those things around, you then can, on your way home, you could be thinking, what do I have in my fridge? What do I have in my freezer? What do I have in my pantry? And how can I turn that into something quick that tastes delicious because I put some time into it when I had time? I also tend to call for ingredients that have done some of that work for you. So fermented ingredients like vinegars and certainly the kimchi and the like can help with that kind of thing. Miso is another one that I like to use a lot because it gives a depth of flavor to things that you're cooking quickly. I think sometimes when you're trying to cook things really quickly, they can taste like it, but that you feel like something's missing. You're using these beautiful fresh vegetables, and they may have a lot of appeal, but there can be sometimes a lack of depth to the flavor, and using those, some of those ingredients can help bring that kind of depth.
Joe, how does this interact with your duties as the food editor?
Well, thankfully can depend on a great team to fill in when I'm on vacation doing book publicity.
Uh-huh.
And last year they held down the fort so beautifully when I took the year off. And as a vegetarian, I am grateful that I have omnivores, carnivores on my team who are interested in meat and can help me make sure that the food section stays omnivorous in nature and appealing to people with all kinds of dietary habits and desires.
And you feel better. You said so.
I do. Yeah, I mean, for me, part of turning vegetarian was a process over the period of a couple of years that involved realizing, A, that I was not cooking meat at home because I was trying to make up for all the meat eating that I was doing at restaurants, and then B, feeling better and then being drawn more toward the vegetable dishes at restaurants, and that happened to coincide, thankfully, with chefs paying more and more attention to creative
treatments
of vegetables.
Which is true. And yeah, I mean, I can see it in the books that come
in.
I see it in the menus. And I see it, and you talk to somebody like Daniel Patterson.
Yeah,
he's
so
been
great.
Doing it for a while. Anyhow, it's Joe Yonan, and it's Eat Your Vegetables, and again, you just produced a very bold, as you say, book with a very accessible, I think, point of view.
Thank you.
So,
thank you. It
yeah.
can be tricky sometimes to
I know.
feel like you can walk that line between simple and interesting when it comes to recipes.
Yeah, but it is. It's both.
Thank you.
All right. Well, you go and enjoy your new employer at the Washington Post.
Thank you.
Yeah. Come back someday and tell us how it's going.
Tell it, yes.
I would be happy to.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks very much, you guys. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Joe. Once again, listeners, we wish you all a happy new year, and we'll see you again same time, same place next week. Till then.
Bye-bye.